Okay, it's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we talk to the co-hosts of NPR's podcast White Lies and WPR's podcast Uprooted about what became of the tens of thousands of Cuban exiles who fled the island and made their way to the United States and to Wisconsin in 1980. Now, the Milwaukee Bucks wrapped up their season yesterday with a loss to the Toronto Raptors, but they finished the regular season with the best record in the NBA and the top seed in the upcoming playoffs. The team is currently the betting favorite to win the NBA Finals. It'd be their second in the last three seasons, if so. We're looking back at another big season for Milwaukee and ahead to what the postseason could bring. Justin Garcia is a studio host and analyst for the Milwaukee Bucks Radio Network and WTMJ in Milwaukee. Justin, thanks for joining us.
Anytime.
Regardless of what comes out of the playoffs, how are you going to remember this Bucks regular season?
I'll remember this regular season, obviously, with more of the individual greatness from Giannis, but this felt like the year of the role player for the Bucks, and really Drew Holiday taking a big step forward as well. When we talked last year about all the games missed for this team, specifically Brooke Lopez, and how that really took their defense from elite to middle of the pack, you thought, okay, the worst is behind us. It can't be that bad in terms of injuries ever again. And this year was worse. When you look at the man games lost, Giannis missed nearly 20 games. You had Chris Middleton, who played in less than half of the team's games this season. You had Drew Holiday in and out. And then a couple of injuries towards the end. Despite all that, if I would have told you at the beginning of the year, here's the games that these key players will miss, nobody would have thought the Bucks would be the number one seed in the East or all of basketball. And I think the reason why is because of those role players. A guy like Javon Carter was huge for this team all throughout the season. Bobby Portis as well, who has a strong chance to be the sixth man of the year. It was all those guys, and Grayson Allen taking a big step forward as well. So it wasn't just the stars for the Bucks this year, and that's one of the things I'll remember most.
That said, how are the stars looking health-wise as they get ready for postseason?
Well, Giannis and Drew Holiday certainly look good, and Brooke Lopez as well. When we mention awards, I mean, he's one of the front runners for Defensive Player of the Year, which is astounding for a man who just turned 35 in a league that's getting younger and younger and who just had back surgery a year ago. But I think the big one you're hinting at is Chris Middleton. By all accounts, they feel relatively good. I mean, it's been a long onboarding process for Chris this season, but having, you know, a week plus off in the case of the last time he played, and now with the play-in tournament, the Bucks finished up the regular season yesterday. They're not going to play again until Sunday. So getting that extra week off and then the last few games as well is going to be key for not only Chris, but even Grayson Allen and Pat Connaughton, who both missed some time. So all things considered, they are in a very good spot going into the postseason where you have, you know, knock on wood, no major issues. You're just waiting on some guys to return to the lineup, and this week off should be great for that.
Giannis Antetokounmpo, two-time NBA MVP. Should he be the third?
Well, I would assume you'd think I'm biased here, but I think he is the MVP. But, you know, I've said all along, and I think most of us have kind of agreed, he is the best player in the league. He is certainly the best two-way player out there. And I think if you surveyed a number of front office executives as well and said, hey, you're starting your own team, you get one pick, who are you choosing? Giannis would be the overwhelming favorite, even going into the postseason. I think Giannis and a guy like Kevin Durant are who you would look at most. If I can give you one player, who do you want? That being said, the way this works is it's a narrative award, and a lot of times it's about when is it your turn. Giannis had those two MVPs. His team didn't win a championship. That was held against him. So then it was Nikola Jokic's turn, and now he's going through the same thing where he won two MVPs. His team lost in the postseason early. So now we look to Joel Embiid, and I've said it's a turns thing. I don't want to discredit what Joel Embiid has done, because that's one of the other remarkable things is you have three generational talents in Giannis, Jokic, and Embiid turning in individually three of the best seasons we've seen in the history of this league. The unfortunate part is they coincide in the same season and you can only pick one.
Just 10 seconds left. I say Bucks in six. How far do you think they're going to go, Justin?
Well, it depends on how they match up with, I think, the Boston Celtics. If you can cure some of that perimeter issues that we saw in the last matchup, I like their chances, certainly early and against any team coming out of the West.
Justin, thanks a lot for joining us.
Anytime.
That's Justin Garcia, studio host and analyst from Milwaukee Bucks Radio Network and WTMJ in Milwaukee, with us for a look ahead at the Bucks postseason. Now it's Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a feature about Short Story Night.
Tons of people are in book clubs these days. Groups of friends get together to talk about a particular autobiography or critique a mystery novel's plotline or drink wine. Perhaps you're someone who wishes they could join a book club but says, how does anyone have time for this? If you are, there's hope, because a Fox Valley librarian has created a monthly event at a local brewery to help even the busiest people continue to be lifelong readers. WPR's Joe Schultz has more on how Short Story Nights have fostered a sense of community for 5 years.
A room with a small stage in Lion's Tail Brewing in Neenah is packed on a Monday. People from all walks of life filter into the brewery to discuss a different short story every month. A murmur begins to fill the room. Then, librarian Richie Zaporowski takes the stage with a microphone.
Hey, I'm Richie from the Neenah Public Library. Thanks for coming out, everyone. This is our fifth anniversary here. Yes. I'm here for 5 years, so let's give it up for 5 years.
Zaborowski hosts Short Story Nights. It's kind of like a book club, but instead of reading a book each month, the group reads one or sometimes a few short stories. Tonight, they're talking about a pair of short stories that center around second-generation immigrants.
This is a story about the mother trying to assimilate into the American culture in a different way, and the daughter...
Zaborowski had the idea for Short Story Nights shortly after becoming a parent. He had two small children at home and wanted to start a traditional book club, but just didn't have the time to read a whole book. He was too busy.
There's people who may not have time for a traditional book club, so this would be a perfect option for them.
Thus, Short Story Nights were born. During the event, Zaborowski leads a conversation about the book. There's also a trivia portion where attendees answer questions tied to the story's theme. And sometimes attendees even interview the authors of the short story they're discussing.
The Short Story Night really produced a great community. You hear about those third spaces all the time. Where can people get together nowadays? And this, I think, is a great third space for people.
Regular attendees agreed with Zaborowski's sentiments about the community forged discussing literature over adult beverages. A few of those attendees are Doug Middleton, Jill Harmon, and Mark Newman.
When I first came, other than this guy here, I didn't know anybody. You know, and I've gotten to know people, you know, the ones that are sort of regulars. It's always fun to sit at a table where I don't know anybody.
People come here from throughout the valley, and it's just a lot of fun seeing them again.
We get to, you know, visit with people, like-minded, you know, they're literary, and you get to talk about concepts, and, you know, I'm not watching college basketball, so it's a nice break.
Well, they all come for the camaraderie. Many admit that Zaborowski's infectious personality is what keeps them coming back. Just ask Harmon.
I'm a big fan of Richie's. He started out almost being a stand-up comic. He'd tell us jokes about his family.
For others, like Pat Rosnick, the back and forth between the audience and Zaborowski is what makes the event fun.
We love to come and give Richie a hard time.
And Zaborowski says the attendees are what keep him energized month in and month out.
I can't say enough about the group. They're just a great group, and they're a lot of fun. And like I said, no one takes it too seriously. We have a great discussion. Everyone listens to each other and where they're coming from, and it's been wonderful.
Aside from the friendships forged, Short Story Nights also give people of all perspectives the opportunity to talk about current events through the lens of literature.
Focusing on contemporary stories really allows us to have a conversation that spans all walks of life, and I think it is a safe space where people can get together and voice their opinions.
Whether young or old, rich or poor, Zaborowski says Short Story Night is an accessible way to enjoy literature and forge friendships. And the adult beverages don't hurt either.
WPR's Joe Schultz brought us that piece on Short Story Nights in Neenah. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, podcasts from NPR and from Wisconsin Public Radio uncover the stories of the Cubans who made their way to the United States in 1980 in what became known as the Mariel Boatlift. We'll look at the lives of thousands of Cuban exiles who came through Fort McCoy here in Wisconsin. That's next on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Back in 1980, more than 100,000 people fled Cuba and made the treacherous journey across the Florida Straits and into the United States. They landed in Key West as part of the Mariel boat lift, a brief period when Cuban President Fidel Castro opened his borders, allowing Cubans to leave the island. About 15,000 of those exiles were sent to Fort McCoy in western Wisconsin. Many were processed before moving in with family or finding sponsors. Some were detained indefinitely by the U.S. government. Some of those people are featured in the podcast from Wisconsin Public Radio, WPR Reports Uprooted, hosted by UW La Crosse professor Omar Granados and WPR's Maureen McCollum. Cuban exiles from the Mariel boatlift are also the focus of the new season of NPR's White Lies podcast, co-hosted by Andrew Beck Grace. I talked to Maureen and Andrew about their reporting earlier today. Andrew, what got you started on the investigations that led you to share these stories of Cuban exiles from the Mariel boatlift?
Well, my partner Chip Brantley and I found this cache of photographs of a prison riot in Alabama in 1991, and it was just a very curious situation where these men had taken over this prison. We found out it was Cuban men who'd all been detained for various, some had committed crimes, but many of them had been detained with no charge, without due process, simply because they were deemed to be ineligible to be admitted into the country. And some of them had been in prison for over a decade. So just finding out about this little toehold we got from the story from this prison riot that happened in 1991, and then realizing there was a much larger, more intense story about our immigration system, about who has the right to have rights, about how we determine these things, we sort of fell down in journalism. You know, we think about this sort of rabbit hole. We sort of fell down the rabbit hole at that point.
And Maureen, we've been listening to your pieces here in Wisconsin. What got you started on these stories of the many of these Cuban exiles who ended up here in Wisconsin?
When I was a student at UW La Crosse, I had found out that during the Mariel boatlift in 1980, when about 125,000 Cubans had come over, about 15,000 of those Cubans had been sent to Fort McCoy in southwest Wisconsin, which is about 45 minutes from La Crosse. And I started looking into it more, and I couldn't read enough on it. But what was so interesting was that when I would find newspaper articles and remembrances of what happened during this time when all these people came through Fort McCoy, it seemed like there weren't many stories about from the Cubans themselves and what their experience was like there, what their experience was like in Cuba. And fast forward to 2020, I made connections with a handful of guys who came through Fort McCoy, ended up putting their roots down in the La Crosse community and staying in La Crosse. And I interviewed them for a Wisconsin Life story just to better understand their lives. And we realized pretty quickly it was a story that was impossible to tell in about 4 minutes. So it turned into a podcast. And what ultimately we wanted to do was, like I said, just better understand what it was that these people went through during their life experience. What was it like growing up in Cuba under Fidel Castro? What was it like making that boat ride across the Florida Straits? What was it like going through Fort McCoy? And more importantly, what has their life been like in Wisconsin since they've decided to settle down here? It really hasn't been easy. And I'm really grateful that they shared their life experience with us.
I want to hear some of those voices. Andrew, you talked to Ernesto Asiego More about his time at Fort McCoy. He told you heard here through an interpreter about how he ended up in a federal penitentiary.
He went through an interview with the INS, and he doesn't know why, but after that, the woman who had interviewed him told the guard to conduct him elsewhere. He refers to the place as a dog pound.
During the interview, when the INS agent asked if he'd ever been in prison in Cuba, he said, in an offhand way, everyone in Cuba has been in prison at some point. She seems to have taken that as an admission of some wrongdoing, because he was immediately detained at Fort McCoy and then sent to the federal prison in Atlanta.
And it turns out, Andrew, in your podcast, you find this was not an uncommon story. How frequently did this sort of thing happen?
Yeah, I mean, it's, as you might imagine, it's not something that the federal government kept great records on, because for all intents and purposes, whenever the press would ask about it, they would say, oh, we've done these comprehensive interviews of these entrants, and we have determined that they had criminal history back in Cuba, so we are going to detain them, basically. But when you get down into the anecdotal evidence of what's actually happening in the prisons at the time, and then the more important sort of legal evidence, you come to realize that it was a very frequent mistake that landed these folks in prison. One man that we tell almost spend a whole episode telling the story of, he basically signed his statement after he had been interviewed and was detained shortly thereafter. And when he finally gets to Atlanta and goes to he's there for 6 weeks without anybody even telling him why he's there. And he goes before an immigration judge, and the immigration judge says, well, you told the interviewer that you were a drug trafficker in Cuba. And he says, I don't know what you're talking about. That's not anything. I'm studying medicine in Cuba. I didn't say anything like that. But he had signed the statement that either the translator had acted maliciously or had just not understood Spanish. I mean, something there, it was frequent that things like this would go wrong. But above and beyond that, what our government did in these cases was detain folks without any committing any crime in this country, all with just a suspicion of criminal activity in Cuba. And that became really interesting to us to sort of unpack through our investigation, was how was it that the federal government essentially made these decisions about these people without having any information from the Cuban authorities at a time when the Mariel boat lift was creating a sort of national imagination about the sort of criminality that Fidel Castro had unleashed onto this country, and a pre-existing crime wave in South Florida had fed into those rumors. And so it was in many ways this sort of self-fulfilling prophecy. And not to mention that about a third of the boat lift was Afro-Cuban. So they sort of dovetailed. They were dark-skinned. They didn't speak English. Many of them were single men. They were working-class people. They sort of dovetailed into all these other sort of stereotypes of criminality and dangerousness that this country has. So I think that's really what we discovered in our investigation.
Talking to Andrew Beck-Grace, co-host of the NPR podcast White Lies, and Maureen McCollum, co-host and executive producer of the podcast WPR Reports Uprooted, looking at the Mariel boat lift. Cuban immigrants to America, refugees, a number of different categories, their lives here in Wisconsin and around the country. Maureen, in your podcast, you give us a taste of life for these Cubans at Fort McCoy here in Wisconsin. I want to listen to Osvaldo Durruti about being at Fort McCoy. He told you about how he would pass the time.
There was a group, musician. We all got together. We started, you know, playing music. And that was when I ended up going to different places. And that was my way out of the environment, the McCoy, you know. Mm-hmm. I just want to get away, you know. You're going to meet people, new faces, Americans, and, you know.
Can you tell us more about what you learned about life at Fort McCoy for these Cuban exiles?
Right. So life at Fort McCoy was incredibly complicated. You know, we've heard from Andrew, and I'm so thankful for the reporting that him and his team did, because they were able to look into these stories about people who just sort of passed through Fort McCoy and then were sent elsewhere. I mean, we had heard these stories, but, you know, based on the people that we had talked with, we weren't able to do any of that reporting. So I'm really thankful that they were able to do that. People like Osvaldo, it's interesting, the people we talk with in Uprooted, this living at Fort McCoy is what they talk the least about. And I think there were a couple reasons for that. One, they don't want to remember. You know, we heard from the gentleman in Cuba who talked about how Fort McCoy is like a dog pound. We heard how from some of the people we talked with, there's one gentleman, Enrique More, who refers to Fort McCoy as the Wild West. There were, you know, at times it was a violent environment. There were assaults. There was corruption among security forces. But I mean, it wasn't all horrible. It wasn't great for a lot of people, but it wasn't also horrible. Like, a lot of the time was actually quite mundane. They spent the time filling out paperwork, kind of waiting for family to come and get them out of there, waiting for sponsors to take them on and find homes for them in Wisconsin or elsewhere. And then, as Osvaldo talked about, he passed the time by playing music. So it was a really musical environment. There were a couple bands that were formed. They had musicians come in and perform. A lot of people played baseball. They played cards. A lot of friendships were formed. They had over 1,000 locals went and became staff at Fort McCoy during the time they were there. So there were a lot of friendships formed. We hear about people working in the mess hall and the cafeteria and finding sponsors just because they're working alongside, you know, a college student from Sparta. And that's one thing that we focus in on in Uprooted too, is just these friendships that were formed. So needless to say, Fort McCoy, it was complicated. It wasn't great. It was bad at times, but there was some good that came out of it.
And Andrew, I used a few different words in rapid succession there: refugees, exiles, immigrants. In legal terms, none of those, I think, is exactly right. And that's part of the story here, this ambiguous situation that these Cubans coming to the United States were in.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a sort of irony of the boat lift that the Refugee Act of 1980 was passed just weeks before the boat lift unfolded, which, you know, for many people watching the boat lift unfold, they thought, well, this is perfect. We have this great new policy to deal with refugees. But it was not intended to deal with a massive influx of people coming across our shores. It was really intended to deal with people in third-party countries that we would essentially have a interview process with and determine how many we're going to bring and set up housing and bring them here. So they weren't refugees. They were technically asylum seekers, although the way they were treated by the immigration authorities and the special status they had essentially said that they were entrants. They had not, from a legal standpoint, the Mariel refugees had not entered the country, even though they were, by all accounts, here. And when they were in McCoy or when they were in Fort Chaffee, they were obviously inside the country. But from the legal perspective, they were asking for entrance into the country, and that determination had not yet been made. So that you can imagine that this put them in the most vulnerable position of anyone who is corporally, who's physically in this country. If the government doesn't think that you're here, then you have no protection. You have no constitutional rights. You have no due process. And that's really what endangered the folks that we sort of investigated and told the story of in White Lies.
And we'll leave it there. Andrew, thanks for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
And Maureen, thanks for sharing your work with us.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
That was Maureen McCollum, co-host of the podcast WPR Reports Uprooted, and Andrew Beck Grace, co-host of the NPR podcast White Lies. They joined me earlier today for a look at what happened to the thousands of Cuban exiles who came to the U.S. and through Fort McCoy here in Wisconsin more than 30 years ago. You can find both links to both podcasts at WPR.org/Central Time. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, the diabetes drug Ozempic is being used for weight loss as well. With a lot of hype around it, a Wisconsin diabetes doctor tells us about the medication and what it means for diabetes treatment. And OPEC Plus cuts back in the oil supply. Jobs numbers wiggle but don't drop. We'll look at the latest economic news and what it means for you. That's tomorrow here on Central Time. Up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then a new report takes a close look at health in Wisconsin and across the country, one county at a time, with a focus on civic life and how that can affect our well-being. Find out where Wisconsin's doing well and where there's room for improvement. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Wisconsin voters approved changes to the state's cash bail system in last week's election. We'll find out what impact the state constitutional amendments could have. First, how healthy is your community? The University of Wisconsin's Population Health Institute has released their annual county health rankings and roadmaps for every county across the country. Here in Wisconsin, the so-called WOW counties, Waukesha, Ozaukee, and Washington, all ranked in the top five of the state's healthiest counties. Neighboring those suburban counties, Milwaukee County ended up near the bottom of the list, ranked 70th out of 72 counties. How can the health outcomes for communities so close to each other end up so far apart? More than 80 factors were considered in this year's county health rankings. And here's one that might surprise you. Our civic life can have big health impacts. You can find a link to this year's report on our website. Go to WPR.org/Central Time. And you can join this conversation at 800-642-1234. Are there things that make your community a healthy, happy place to live? What are they? What could your community do to improve health outcomes? What would you like to see happen to increase social and economic opportunities for others, which, as we'll find out, is a factor in our well-being? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Sherry Johnson is director of the UW Population Health Institute and the principal investigator of the County Health Rankings and Roadmaps that's funded by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. Sherry's also a professor of population health sciences at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Sherry, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
As I mentioned, a lot of factors go into this report. Can you give us the big picture? What are you hoping we can learn from this county-by-county health report?
Correct. So nearly every year in the last sort of 12 years, we've taken an annual look at the health of nearly every county in the United States. And we use a model of health that helps us understand that health is determined by a lot of factors, things like the social and economic conditions that we live in, the physical environment, our access to clinical care or health services, and our health behaviors. And so we use that model of health to spark conversations in local communities, to help local communities really dig into their data to try to look at where they have strengths in some of those areas and where there's room for improvement. And this year we focused on civic health, and we thought about it in two ways. We thought about it in terms of civic infrastructure, which includes the places where we can gather, learn about each other, understand the democratic process, as well as civic participation. And that includes the way that we participate in community life, things like volunteering and mentoring, but also voting and having a say-so in policy.
And I want to spend some time on that civic infrastructure and its impact on our health. I want to look first, though, at one thing that seems to be consistent with past versions of this report, a continuing racial disparity when it comes to health outcomes. And that might be from one county to another, but the report points out even in a county like Dane County that looks pretty good on the report, you're still seeing those disparities there. Can you talk about what you found and the persistence of these disparities over the years?
Yeah, so one of the new features this year that you can take a look at in the county snapshot is a bit of a historical descriptor statement. It includes a link to an opportunity to learn about the Native nations that lived on the land of that county. And it also includes information about counties that experienced one particular type of policy, redlining, that has a long arc of impact in terms of the social and economic resources that are available in certain communities and promote health, and that were intentionally made unavailable in other communities and have detracted from health. So that's a really important addition to understanding why things are the way they are and why groups of people in different places and different counties across our state have not had the opportunity to experience the same quality of health or length of life because of historical policy and practice like redlining.
Can you talk a little more about the practical impacts of something like redlining, a big tool in maintaining segregation in a lot of Wisconsin communities? What are some of the specific health impacts of that here in 2023?
Right. So if you think about the way that redlining allowed some people to purchase homes and to build equity in those homes and then have both economic cushion to respond to any sort of financial shocks that they might experience, but also to invest in the future of their families and communities by having the resources available for example, higher education or home purchases for future generations. So there's a generational impact that wealth building has had, and that generational impact has been different for those that were discriminated against through federal policy that deemed some neighborhoods unworthy of investment, and the people that lived in those neighborhoods then did not experience the same opportunity as those who were able to get those federal loans. So also think about the way that residential segregation is linked to school segregation and segregation through a more modern practice of digital redlining, where many of those same neighborhoods that were redlined through federal policy now have less access to digital broadband services, which are a key part of the civic infrastructure that we lift up in this year's report as well.
Talking to Sherry Johnson, director of the UW Population Health Institute and principal investigator of the report we're talking about. It's called the County Health Rankings and Roadmaps Report. It goes county by county in Wisconsin and around the country. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think makes your community a healthier place to live or a less healthy place to live? And we're going to get into this idea of civic infrastructure. Now, think about things like parks in your community, libraries, community centers for seniors or teens or everybody in between. Do you have those? Do you wish you have those? How big a part of your life are they if you do have them? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Sherry, can you talk a little more about this idea of civic infrastructure? I gave a couple tastes of what that might mean. What were you looking at in this report?
Right. So you did name some of the key places that we focused in on. So places like libraries and parks that can foster social connection, as well as policies such as automatic voter registration and early in-person voting that allow people to engage. So it's both the places that we invest in, that we allocate our shared resources to, and the policies that form an infrastructure that can make participation in decision-making processes easy and available to as many people as possible.
Now, people might hear that and say, hey, wait a minute. I thought this was a health report. What's the civics doing here? What is the civics? Can you draw the line between those civic foundations and policies and the well-being of a community?
Right. So those infrastructure elements are the places that we know also correlate to resources that are necessary for health. So things like adequately funded schools and parks and broadband internet are part of the civic infrastructure. Broadband internet became really important during the pandemic for a number of things, whether it was telehealth access or access to social benefits that became available to help people meet their basic needs. When you think about parks, you can think about access to exercise opportunities, access to gather with neighbors and even new people that you haven't met yet to understand each other's perspectives and come to some shared understanding of priorities for resource allocation. So there are a lot of different ways that civic infrastructure can create the places and strategies for us to come to some agreement about how we construct the conditions that are necessary for good health.
In the report, you give some case studies of communities that, might have had a difficult civic infrastructure situation, but decided they didn't have to live with that and made some changes. One you looked at was Greenville County, home to Greenville, South Carolina. Can you talk about what you learned from that experience?
Yeah, that was a place where there was a lot of grassroots organizing around transportation barriers, and they gathered many local residents to help shine a light on the importance of equitable transportation, and were able to see some substantial investment in transportation to particularly neighborhoods that, again, had been negatively impacted by previous policy, and improved the county public transportation overall. So local advocates who were called green shirts were instrumental in collecting input and signatures from bus riders and lifted up those concerns to local leaders about the need for enhanced services. And they ultimately got an $11 million grant for a new maintenance facility. They got electronic payments instead of cash payments that folks weren't even getting their change back. They got expanded hours and new routes to underserved areas. So that link from civic participation, so people who are closest to the problem of inadequate transportation, collecting data on the bus from other people, and then using that data and their own personal experience to advocate for a better system that is beneficial to the whole county.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Mark is with us in Madison. Mark, hello.
Hello. I'm interested. All these health metrics are interconnected, as your guest has pointed out. Is there one metric that a community focused on would have the most impact on the others?
Oh, interesting question, Mark. Is there one particular aspect here that might be the low-hanging fruit, that big investment that's going to pay off the most, Sherry?
It is a great question, and we actually have more than 90 measures in the county snapshot for local change makers to take a look at, to understand, and then to really make those local decisions together about what makes the most sense. So the short answer would be no, there isn't one measure that we think all communities should focus on. You can look at your data, you can disaggregate it, meaning break it up by different racial and ethnic groups to better understand if everybody is having the same opportunities and outcomes. You can think about, you know, where you have the most shared priorities and start there. So there's a lot of ways I think that people can use the data for action. And that's really what we hope, that this is a spark of a conversation, and it's a public good resource that people can use to make change.
Mark, thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Sherry Johnson, director of the University of Wisconsin Population Health Institute, principal investigator of the report we're talking about titled County Health Rankings and Roadmaps. She's with us to talk about this year's rankings for Wisconsin counties and the many factors that go into building healthy communities. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about this report, this idea of civic infrastructure? When you look around you at your own community, do you see a lot of that? Are there parks where people get together and you can meet your neighbors? Are there libraries, community centers, schools that let people have public meetings, things like that, where you can go and feel connected to your community? Do you wish you had more of that? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Sherry Johnson, director of the University of Wisconsin Population Health Institute. We're talking about this year's County Health Rankings and Roadmaps report and the many variables that go into creating healthy communities. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you see health disparities within your community? What should your local government say or local leaders be doing to improve health outcomes? And this report focuses on civic life, civic infrastructure. Do you feel like you have that in your town? Places where people gather, maybe people from different backgrounds. Have you tried to make a change in your community? Who did you reach out to? How did it work? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Sherry, you mentioned change makers in communities. I think you're hoping that your report gets used by people who want to make change. Who are you looking at when it comes to people, your audience for the report and what they're going to do with it?
Yes, so we hope that change makers from across the spectrum take a look at the report. So that means grassroots organizers who are working on making sure that everyone who's eligible to vote can vote. That means elected officials who are responsible for making policy for all of us in Wisconsin. It means organizational and institutional leaders across sectors, so the healthcare sector, but also the housing sector, the governmental public health workforce. For example, the American Medical Association has declared recently that voting is an important determinant of health. The American Public Health Association has made similar declaration. The Healthy People 2030 has included voting as a research objective. So there are a number of organizations that are rallying around this concept of civic participation and the many ways that we can take steps together to improve civic participation and ultimately improve how long and how well we live.
I want to look at another community you highlighted. This one, Cornelius, Oregon, and how Latino groups there have helped to improve their overall civic health. What did you see there? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Cornelius was a great story. So this is a small suburb outside of Portland where a growing Latino population was not yet fully engaged in the decision-making process. And so local leaders in community organizations as well as in government got together to try to expand their engagement and used a number of strategies and have seen some really great outcomes. So now more than 50% of the commissions and boards in that community have Latino representation. There was a very concrete outcome in terms of them working together to create a new housing structure for seniors that also includes a library on the first floor. And that allows the school children from a nearby school to interact with seniors and with bilingual librarians. So they've really taken this concept of civic participation, leading to the resourcing of civic infrastructure and really expanding the voices of people in the community who have input into how we use our shared resources. It's a great story.
And as I'm reading the story, it sounds like, you know, some people in local government and some people with local Latino groups work together. They form this partnership. Now, if somebody is a local leader or a change maker and says, gosh, we're doing all this work here, but there is a part of our community that isn't at the table. What do you recommend for them to help reach out and start making those connections?
Right. I think it's starting with understanding who are the leaders in that community, that there are local leaders at the grassroots level that are part of many of the communities that have not had a fair seat at the table. So it's reaching out to those leaders, being present in their meetings and social activities to really get to know them and to understand their priorities and perspectives. And then being systematic, I think the way that Cornelius was in terms of building the opportunity for participation through things like dual language town hall meetings and dual language surveying, that really has made measurable change in that community.
We've got a link to the report at WPR.org/Central Time. People can go there and look at their own county or any county they're interested in. Can you give some guidelines, some suggestions for people who want to take this for a spin, see what they can learn from it and see what they can do with it?
Yeah, so please go to countyhealthrankings.org to take a look at your county snapshot. You just type in either your zip code or your county name, and you'll see an array of data that you can also look at in comparison to other counties in Wisconsin, as well as national rates. And then I want to draw attention to something called What Works for Health, which is part of our website, and it's a goldmine of more than 400 strategies and programs that have been analyzed for levels of effectiveness. So when you want to get to the take action part, you can go to What Works for Health and find evidence-informed strategies, things like expanding civic education for our K-12 students so that they're fully prepared to participate and lead our democracy going forward. There are things like voter turnout initiatives that can help expand representation in the democratic process. And so take a look at What Works for Health if you are interested in strategies that have been analyzed and reviewed for effectiveness. And the website is countyhealthrankings.org.
And I'm guessing research of this scale gives a lot of answers, but probably also raises a lot of questions. Sherry, what top questions on your mind now coming out of this report process?
So every year we ask ourselves, what is missing? What else do we need to add to help local communities take their work a step forward? So this year's focus on civic health, including civic infrastructure and civic participation, was part of that process of asking ourselves, what else is needed? And we plan to continue to dig deeper into what often are called those more upstream drivers of health. So looking away from personal behaviors, understanding that personal behaviors are nested in a set of conditions that are created by our social and political processes. How do we help people understand that, measure it, improve it is sort of the path that we're on.
Sherry, thanks for sharing your work with us today.
Thank you for inviting me.
That's Sherry Johnson, director of the University of Wisconsin Population Health Institute, principal investigator of the County Health Rankings and Roadmaps Report, and a professor of population health sciences at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. She joined us today with a look at this year's report, how the health of Wisconsin's counties measures up. You can find a link to that report and check out what's going on in your neck of the woods. We've got a link at WPR.org/Central Time. Coming up after the news, the cash bail system in Wisconsin is changing after voters passed referendums last week. A criminal law professor joins us to explain the changes and the possible impact they could have. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.